know. Courtney, are you new to the Brownfields Job Development Program?
I am. I think, I'm not sure if Courtney's new, but I'm definitely new.
Oh, great. Well, it's a great program. We've had over 100 grantees that have set up job development programs around the country. HMTRI, which Glow and I work with, help programs get started and help them more efficiently once they get started. And we get all the grantees together, and we also try to get grantees to help mentor each other so that some people will have some ideas of what works and some will have things that don't work in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the whole purpose of Brownfields Job Development is to set up programs locally, job development programs, training programs, so that people in the community can get the jobs that are created by the economic redevelopment.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Who just joined us?
This is Tim Bull, St. Louis Community College.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
Good. And how are you?
I'm good.
We've, in fact, Tim's got a great program that's been in existence for quite a while in St. Louis area, and we have them in many of the urban areas to help get some of these programs started. EPA has an annual grant award of about $200,000, which isn't really designed to run the program. It's designed as kind of startup money to get you going, and they also re-up those programs, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small budget, but it gets people going.
Yeah.
Hi, who just joined us?
Daniel Kintz, North Star Center for Human Development, Hartford, Connecticut.
Hi, Daniel. How are you today?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm good. We're just getting started. Someone else just joined?
Rebecca Rostock, Cochise College.
Hi, Rebecca.
Okay.
Hi.
And, we also have some tribes and Native American programs going. How's your program going, Rebecca?
The Pathways program is great. We've got a Haswapper class going on right now on its second day. We just finished a forklift class Friday and a lead paint renovator class. So
fantastic. Fantastic.
A lot of them going on through that grant.
Hi, who just joined us?
Hi, this is Christina Wilson from EPA Region 8.
Hi, Christina.
Hello.
We get to have an EPA person online today. For those of you who are not familiar with the EPA structure, we have headquarters in Washington, and like all of the federal programs, we've got all of the regions, the 10 regions. And Christina happens to be from one of the best regions, 8. And she is actually, are you the Brownfields job training person over in Region 8, Christina?
I am, and actually the reason I'm calling, I've had questions about the labor market assessment, so I was hoping to learn from you all so I can pass that on.
Great.
Well, today, so that's what caught my eye.
We're going to be talking about that, and we're also going to be talking about a question, and we'll get started because we try to keep these calls down to about 30 minutes so that it doesn't take a large portion of the day.
Hi, who just joined us?
Jared Taylor from Youth Build Louisville.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well. Yourselves?
I'm great.
Good. Before we get started on labor markets assessments, and we wanted to answer a question that was posed by one of the members, Al Dyson, during this last week. We have these calls every 2 weeks, and in between, people might raise questions. And his question is, he had several abandoned industrial sites in several neighborhoods with boarded-up houses. How do I determine if they're brownfield sites? Is the answer results from phase one and phase two assessment? Can property like an abandoned meat packing plant or a chemical plant be deemed a brownfield by definition and based over 30 years of manufacturing operation using various chemicals in the 50s, 60s, and 70s? So we want to get into labor market assessments and working with the community, but we wanted to look at this little background question. Of course, for those of you who may or not be familiar with brownfields, originally there was a EPA came out with a definition of what brownfields were, and it's changed slightly over the years. The current definition is pretty much real, the expansion, real property, the formal definition, real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of hazardous substance, pollutants, or contaminants. Brownfields means a lot of things to a lot of different people. There are local brownfields, there's state brownfields, there's federal brownfields, there's voluntary cleanup sites. To put in a general simplistic way, all of these are properties that have been polluted, or they thought they were polluted. There may be pollution, or there is pollution on these properties. They're different than Superfund sites that are the very nasty sites. We love canal. We think of that Superfund site. These are not quite that contaminated, but they do have contamination and can't be used for many purposes. They are basically abandoned properties, and Tim is very familiar with St. Louis area. They've got square miles of abandoned property in St. Louis that they're redeveloping. The question is, people have, as you've got the official federal brownfields, and these are, and there are grants that are given to clean these up, and you hear about the RLF, the assessment grants, the cleanup grants. RLF stands for Revolving Loan Fund.
Someone just join us?
Yeah, hi, Glo. This is Valerie. Mike.
Hi, Valerie.
Hi.
We're talking about a question about brownfields and getting clear what these brownfields are and how you qualify them. Tim Binkley from Winston-Salem, who has done a lot of work in this area as a consultant, was going to be on today, but he's teaching a class and has a lab, but he sent me something he'd like me to share with everyone about brownfields that I'd like to read and tell you a little bit about Tim. As his overview, we've got a lot of different ideas of what brownfields are, and they vary from state to state. So we've got the federal official version, and those that are funded by the federal government, and they're funded in different ways. They're funded as brownfield assessment pilots, pilot grants where they just provide money to determine what's on the property. Then there's cleanup grants to actually clean up the property. There's also revolving loan funds. You'll hear the voluntary cleanup program, which is a little different. The property isn't necessarily abandoned. It's owned by somebody, but they go into an agreement with a regional person, person in the region, like Region 8, and they would cease from enforcement action with certain conditions and a plan for cleaning up the property. As far as the brownfields training program, these all kind of qualify for setting up a training program, putting people to work. But to get back to Al Dyson's question of his property, let me read a little bit about what Tim Binkley wants to share with the group as far as his background of brownfields. He says, as a general overview, brownfields in the larger sense are simply properties that have been abandoned or underutilized as a result of real or perceived contamination. As I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be there. We just don't know. But we think it's there. Before any assessment is done, it matters very little whether or not the contamination is real, because the perception alone is often enough to scare prospective redevelopers away. There may have been a dry cleaner, for example, on the site. That dry cleaner may or may not have spilled solvents into the ground, but if they think it did, it is a potential for being a brownfield. And that's why we have what we call assessment pilots. The assessment grants are to determine the extent there is pollution at that site. In a regulatory sense, however, potential brownfield sites have to meet several important criteria. One, the parties that stand to benefit from the sale redevelopment cannot have contributed to the contamination. The ideal brownfield site is one in which no responsible party, we call them RPs, can be found, and the property is held by owners that had nothing to do with contaminating it. They could be an estate heir, a municipality that got the property through condemnation or contribution. St. Louis, Tim could tell us, at some length, I'm sure, of what happens in St. Louis when they abandon for tax purposes or just walk away from properties. And the city is basically stuck with the property. The project must have a public benefit. That is, even though a developer will reap income from the redevelopment, the project must be able to demonstrate that it will, in fact, provide some benefit like jobs, increased tax revenue, improved safety conditions, or so forth. Projects that are transparent and involve the community through public meetings and education. In other words, the public, and this will get into what we talk about today and working with the community, has to be involved all the way along the line, very transparent and very public. The sites must not be already regulated under some other program. For example, a wood treating facility that's still in operation, and it might be working with a RCRA program to address the environmental issues, it can't become a brownfield, even though it meets the requirements of having known contamination. In other words, it's a known and existing operating facility under an enforcement action. Superfund sites may not qualify, depending on whether the site is already being addressed through voluntary cleanup portion, or whether or not there are known responsible parties who are avoiding compliance. Risk, those sites that are on the site's priority list as extreme risk typically cannot be considered because the risk imposed an imminent threat to human health and environment. In other words, we might push them into a Superfund site rather than a brownfield. The site must not be primarily contaminated by releases or leaks from underground storage tanks. Now, underground storage tanks or our abandoned gas stations are an interesting issue because about halfway between when brownfield started and now, there was a big underground storage tank program, and there was a big effort by states to clean up these programs. Most of the states ran out of money, and it's recently kind of fallen into the brownfield arena. Many states have what we call UST programs that would supersede brownfields. If, however, a site contains waste that includes primary listed hazardous materials such as tetrachloroethylene, carbon tetrachloride, etc., commingled with the underground storage tanks, it might qualify as a brownfield. Service spills of petroleum product as opposed to underground releases might also qualify as a brownfield because they're covered by the Oil Spill Act and not the underground storage tanks. However, it's often less costly in terms of time to remediate surface spills that don't reach groundwater through means other than brownfields. The cost of petroleum waste removal is substantially less than hazardous materials removal in a shorter time frame if you go through the brownfields process. And let me talk about this. In North Carolina, for example, it costs about $5,000 just to apply for a brownfield status in North Carolina. It may take 1 to 1.5 years to get the application reviewed and work through the assessment issues. Many developers aren't willing to wait for an unknown period of time to get an answer. So some try to fast-track it. And if they fast-track an application in North Carolina, for example, it costs $30,000. So often it doesn't make sense to go through a formal brownfields application process and get a formal brownfields designation. It's just better just to go clean it up. Dry cleaning sites that are contaminated with chemicals that were used in the past, up to 5 or 10 years ago, are typically good possibilities for brownfields. But we also have to remember that some states have their own special programs for dry cleaning facilities. North Carolina, for example, has a special programs for dry cleaners. So you might not go under the official brownfields program, but you would go under a state of North Carolina program that would be specially suited to dry cleaning. So the takeaway from everything that Tim has said here is what you need to do is you need to talk. Property is really on a state-by-state, site-by-site basis. And some states, it's very long involved process to go through the brownfields application process and become an official brownfields. Some cases, you can it's very easy to become, for example, a state brownfield or a local brownfield. You're still, in the spirit of brownfields, you're still a brownfield. You may not be an official brownfield that's getting federal funding, but you would still be considered as a, say, a state brownfield site or a brownfield site under a special designation. So what Tim is trying to tell us is you're going to see abandoned gas stations, you're going to see underground storage tanks, you're going to see dry cleaners in your community, you're going to see areas that have fences around them. We all call these as brownfields, and there's probably remediation and assessment and cleanup occurring at these sites. They may not be official EPA brownfields, but they're still there. So we use the term kind of loosely when we talk about brownfields, but there's just kind of keep in mind there's the official brownfields, which is a federal official brownfields, and then as we migrate down to the local, we've got all these other kind of brownfields programs. And the reason, and to answer Al's question, is if you're a polluter, you're responsible for cleaning up your property. Just because you've polluted your property doesn't mean you can get a grant to clean it up from the federal government or the state government. You're a responsible party. You have to clean up your own mess, and you're subject to enforcement actions if you don't. If it's abandoned property and someone has walked away from it and the city owns it, now we do have candidates for brownfields. There might be community development corporations that acquire the land and they apply for a brownfields grant to clean it up. There might be partnerships with redevelopment companies that are going to make a, as Tim talked about 2 weeks ago, a large developer coming in and redeveloping a very large brownfields area. And I think as Tim expressed, these are long-term and takes a lot of negotiating to get these brownfields up and running. I know Tim was talking about the TIF, incremental tax incentives, where they freeze the real estate value at the level it was when it was polluted, and then as you develop the land and it gets more valuable, that increased tax revenue that would come from that can be an incentive to develop the property. And these have become fairly complicated negotiations and take a lot of money and a lot of time to get started. So they do take time. What this means for job training is that our people that we're setting up our job training programs for have potential employers in all of these different types of cases. They could work at these official federal brownfield sites, but there's a whole lot of others that aren't. They might be underground storage tanks. They might be voluntary cleanups. They might be revolving loan funds that are being used to rehabilitate a brownfield. All of these kind of fall into that category. Does that leave everyone pretty much in the dark of what a brownfield is, or does anyone want to add to what Tim has provided us with in terms of brownfields and getting brownfield designation? Any feelings out there? No?
I think that was a great description of brownfields.
Pretty much what you go through over in Region 8, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was very in-depth, and I think that covered most all the aspects that I'd touch on, too,
yeah.
And probably many more.
There are, and it's when we go to brownfields, it'll be 2011, it's interesting because you see people divided into different groups. We've got the job training people, and it's 4,000 or 5,000 people at this big convention everyone goes to every 2 years, 18 months. There's the job training people. There's the techies who are doing cleanup, and they've got all their instruments and analysis. And then you've got the insurance people and the banks or the financing and real estate people. And it's kind of fun because you could tell by the way people dress which group they fall into. So as you're going through the exhibit hall, you kind of see the silk suits, and then you see the blue jeans. And when you go to the sessions, it's kind of a similar type thing. But all of these groups are involved. So.
Hey, Mike, Al Dyson.
Yes, sir. Who is this that just joined?
Al Dyson.
Oh, hey, Al, we just talked about your question. You're 5 minutes too late. Well, we just answered it, and it'll be in the post-session notes. Al had a great question, and we just talked about brownfields and how they qualify. And we'll put these in the post-session notes, and I'll talk about what Tim talked about them. But in a two-minute sum up, Al, if you're a polluter, you're responsible for cleaning up your own property. So if you own it and you've got it, and you're currently operating, you're going to have to clean it up. If it's abandoned and it's been given to the city, and I use St. Louis because Tim's on the line, they've got almost square miles of abandoned property that was polluted, and people just let the taxes, and then the city ended up with it. So then their abandoned property lists is huge tracts of land. When it's that case, it becomes a brownfield and can become a brownfield. But the process is fairly long and involved if you want to get a federal funding for it. And some states, it's quite expensive. But that doesn't mean there aren't brownfields, and you can't train and develop programs to work in what we call brownfield sites, because there's a lot of informal brownfields out there. And there's a lot of voluntary cleanup going on where people need people to clean up their dry cleaners or their storage facilities or their mechanic sheds. And so there are, the loose term, many, many brownfields. We're talking about 500,000 brownfields. The official brownfields may be a tenth of that that are federally designated, but there are many. And I think there is about close to 1,000 federal brownfields right now, but they estimate 500,000 other brownfields that aren't federal official brownfields. And the implication for job training is we're training for all of those brownfields. And this gets into this whole idea of how do we determine what the need is for our people that we're going to be training. And particularly in this job environment, you do not want to take the attitude that I say some universities use, or we will build them, we will develop these people, and people will hire them. We're more like the community college model, where let's see what the community needs, and then let's train to those needs. So the whole idea of what brownfield job training is about is, let's see what kind of jobs are going to be needed in our community, and let's train and provide the certifications that will meet those needs. And this is where the needs assessment comes in. And the answer in a needs assessment and doing a good needs assessment is not sending out a survey. That's the easy way, but it just does not develop very good results, because people will see a survey first. Few will respond, and the other one is you don't hit usually in a survey the right people that you need to hit. A better answer to a good needs assessment might be doing some surveying, but first doing an assessment of the types of industries that are in your area. And those types of industries are divided into those who pollute or have a potential for polluting, those who clean up, and those who help people clean up. For example, manufacturers of pollution equipment would be those who help clean up. Those who clean up, we think of the typical remediation firms that are Clean Harbors and the typical type of responding firms. And then, of course, the polluting firms. Now, that's a tougher one, because there are a whole lot of polluting firms, and some of them don't even realize they may have one or two jobs, but they do need someone that is familiar with lockout tagout procedures or Hazwoper procedures. And these might be firms, you might think someone like UPS, for example, has a huge hazardous materials and particularly in the transportation area, materials handling, spills, emergency response, same with FedEx. Now, if you were to send out a blanket survey, they may not respond in a very positive way. You have the obvious people who are your remediation contractors, but you may not have a remediation contractor in your community. So what you need to do first is start looking at industries that may require someone who has either certification or types of training. Painters, for example, contractors. People don't think that contractors would need it, but now with the new RRP regulations, we've got a tremendous need for their RMP certifications for painters, house remodelers, builders, are all now candidates for hiring people that we would be training. So first you have to get this overview of the general commerce in your community. And it's best to stay local because our job training programs tend to be local. So you draw a circle around your community, whether it's 50 miles, and then you start looking certainly at the major employers, but then you start circling down at the not-so-major employers and industries that in the three groups I just talked about. And then, ideally, you start calling them up, and if you can talk to HR directors, and you start talking to them about their needs of and have they hired anyone that needs a certification? Are they dealing with lead or asbestos or any of these products? So then you start to get a feel for the actual need in your community. The nice thing about a needs assessment, as I just described, is that as you're doing this process, you're building a database, and as you train people and they come out of your program, you're going to have contacts that you can call and say, you know, a year ago when we were developing our program, you indicated that you might need some people with RRMP, this is the lead health and protection EPA regulation that came out last spring. You indicated that because of these new regulations, you may need some people that have the certification. Well, next June, we're going to have 12 people that will have a certification. Would you be interested in coming to one of our awareness nights where we're going to meet with these people? And so what we've done is two things at once. We've done a needs assessment, and then at the same time, we've started to build our Rolodex, our database of prospective employers that we could contact later. And so you're kind of doing two things at once. And when we start talking about the RFP, developing the proposal for the EPA funding, which we'll be talking about in future sessions, it's going to be important to demonstrate how did you do your needs assessment. Did you just send out a survey and come back with, well, there's not much need, not much demand in our community, or how in-depth, how innovative were you in your needs assessment? Did you do a industrial scan of potential employers, peripheral employers? Did you do that? Did you talk to HR directors as part of it? Did you also include these people and start building a database? So, for example, if you were writing a narrative in a proposal on how you did your needs assessment, if you not only explained, yes, you did some traditional surveys, but you surveyed major industries and you actually contacted 100 potential employers, and of those 100, you found a need for people with RRMP certifications or a need for people with general construction, OSHA 10, and RRP, and also everyone needed a HAZWOP, and that these people would be interested in hiring your graduates. This is an extremely powerful needs assessment, which is, it's not strictly objective, it's more subjective, it's a little mushier because it's softer than just sending out a survey and said, we sent out 10,000 surveys and here's the mean deviation and here is the results. That does you not a lot of good when it's time to develop relationships with potential employers, where this other, you could do that, but if you do the other personal contact, you are all of a sudden working with community and you're developing this relationship. Not only that, you're generating an interest, and as you're doing your needs assessment, you may find that you're going to be recruiting people for your advisory board And they might say, well, I'll give you an example. We, in one of our grantee communities, they started to do a needs assessment. They didn't get too far. They came across a tank manufacturer. This is East Palo Alto, long time ago. The tank manufacturer said, heck, we'll hire everyone you graduate. We need everyone you graduate. We've had several grantees who have had that kind of experience where as they started making personal contacts in their needs assessment, they said, heck, if I like your program and I can have input on how you're going to train them and what certs you're going to have, I'll take them all, or I'll take a good portion of them. And right then, before you've even started in the very planning part of your program, you've already taken care of your advisory board. You've taken care of, you can train your graduates, and you can say, hey, guys, I've got five employers, and they're all interested in anyone that comes out of this program. You can tell your students positively that there's a job at the end of the tunnel. So it's a very powerful needs assessment. So it's just we could call it working with the community. We could call it needs assessment. We can call it recruitment or of employers. But these are people who are going to participate in your program, hire your employees, they're going to support your program. In some cases, they may give you financial and in-kind support. We've had instances where they said, well, we may hire some of your students, but tell you what, we have hazmat equipment, and we don't use it all the time. And if you want to borrow it to do your fit, to do your instruction on fit tests, or we can send over an instructor. We've had people who have worked with consulting firms, and the consulting firm, we're going to hire people, but also they sent instructors over and provided in-kind partnering to the training program because they were interested. It was in their best interest because then they get to know the students and they get to teach the program the way they'd like to see it taught. So you'll find that there's a really good incentive for a very strong, we're terming it needs assessment early on, and it's contact with the community. Is that, Tim, that's kind of what you guys do, isn't it? You work very closely to your community, don't you?
Yeah, we talk a lot with the community-based organizations and then just different, some of the different employers about what their needs may be upcoming, because they have an idea of what kind of bids they have out and what their staffing levels are going to be.
Yeah.
So we try to stay in constant contact with them, let them know when our graduation dates are going to be and, you know, what their needs are.
Yep. Are you finding it a tough sell in this economy, or is it?
It's a pretty tough sell just because the construction industry is pretty slow.
Yeah.
You know, the banks aren't letting go of the money, so, you know, everybody says they've got bids out. They're just waiting to get the green light.
Yeah. It's a difficult situation. Rebecca, how about you? How is the employment situation where you're at?
We have actually one big employer who is willing to hire a lot of the people who are coming through the Pathways program. It's Freeport MacMoran, who is bought out Phelps Dodge, which had a huge mining operation here. They're doing a bunch of remediation. So they're hiring pretty much everybody that we get through the Pathways program.
That's a perfect example of, now, if you were to back up and say you hadn't started a program yet, Rebecca, and you started, for example, going through the phone book or starting what major employees do we have, Freeport, it's a mining company, you know, you probably would think, well, they probably have environmental people, but you could do two things. You just sent them a survey with 10,000 other surveys, or you go in and you start talking to them. And in your case, if you would have talked to them, which you probably did, or they found, did you seek them out, or they sought you out when they found out about you?
Sought them out. I knew the site manager there from other things.
Mm-hmm.
And first, I invited him to be on the technical advisory committee for the college. And that's where I'm going to take the questionnaire, the needs assessment, to that committee meeting and pass it out to everybody there, including Freeport MacMoran, who will be at that meeting as well, for the Brownfields training grant. So, I will also be out knocking on doors.
Yeah, what you really want to do is you want to demonstrate how you've made personal contact with the community and with community employers. So you want to, as part of your needs assessment, you want to talk about not only that you did the survey, but you sat down with the Freeport people, and they gave an indication that they have a strong demand, and they will look at your program very seriously and may be a very good source. Now, just think how many other Freeport types of companies there may be in your area. That was just one. And with our programs, they're fairly small. We're talking about 10, 20 people per cycle. It's nothing for them to take half your graduates because it's not like we're graduating hundreds of people at one time. So it really is nice if you can get two or three people like that. And of course, once you get your own graduates into the program, it self-sustains itself, where if they do well, they come back for more.
I have a question. I've actually, we don't have that problem here. We have lots of brown sites in the Utica area. We have 85 brown sites alone.
Wow.
And there's 9 major agencies that are handling those sites. My problem is I can't seem to get in touch with any of their HR departments. I'm not getting any responses, any phone calls. I've sent out flyers, numerous information packets, and made plenty of phone calls, but I'm not getting any responses from those.
Who's speaking, please?
This is James Lee with the Utica Workforce Investment Board.
Where? From where?
I'm sorry?
Repeat it, please.
This is James Lee.
I couldn't understand it.
I'm sorry. I can't hear this person.
James Lee with the Workforce Investment Board. And is that Utica, New York?
Yes.
Utica, New York. And you're with the WIB, Workforce Investment Board, kind of like associated with Department of Labor.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not getting good response. Anyone have any good advice for James?
Can he pose the question once more? Can you pose it for him?
Yes. James has got lots of brownfields. He's got 85 brownfields.
Major agencies that are actually working the brownfields.
And he's got 9 agencies that are working with these 85 brownfields. But he's calling the HR directors, and he's not getting a response from any of the HR directors from these major companies.
Okay. The solution I have for him, this is Daniel from North Star. One, to actually go out to these sites on your own and find out who the project manager or the site managers for that site, and of course, grab their card, and also just talk to them. You have to at some point you have to come out of the office and actually see what's happening on these brownfield sites. The second is to find out who are the people that are actively involved at your city, to see how they're getting their funding to clean up these sites. That'll give you some insight as well as in order to get started on any of these brownfields, the city have to put out an actual public announcement. And you have to attend some of those meetings up front so that you know who are the players in getting this site cleaned up. That's been my experience here in Hartford, where I'm getting actively involved with the community as well as actively involved with the city to find out what's happening with these brownfield sites before they even kick off. But if they already started, go out to the sites and find out who are the project managers, grab their business cards, and find out who are the names of certain people that are heavily involved in a project. And from there, you can begin to link your students up, your graduating students up, with their needs, and you can build a relationship from there. I have successfully got a few of my graduates that graduated. Actually, the class has finished last week. The graduation is actually next weekend, and I already have some of my guys in my class already working on brownfield, which are actually abandoned properties here in Hartford. And I did that by actually contacting the city, going out to community meetings, making contact, so when the work was about to start, they contacted me first to let me know, so I can get my students involved with the project.
So basically, you're saying, don't worry about the HR directors; go right to the technical people if you can.
That's absolutely 100% right. The HR does make the decision. Like, but remember, HR just handles the paperwork and they make the decision. But ultimately, the decision is made on who really is doing the hiring. Normally, the project manager doing the hiring. They're reporting back, and they're assessing their needs. So I would say skip the HR, because that's one gatekeeper that's holding you back from accomplishing your goal of getting these guys onto the site and getting them working. So I recommend you go to the site, visit it, reach out to all the contractors, reach out to the city, find out who the names and the players are in these certain brownfields and who is doing the cleaning, the cleanup, because the HR is just, again, one individual in the office that doesn't quite may not know what's going on in the field. And at some point in time, you have to go out there and see what's happening out in the field.
So basically, if you either contact the city, whoever is responsible, it could be the city or it could be the DNR state, and try to talk to someone who's in the brownfields department and tell them you've got a brownfields job training program and you're trying to connect with the, not necessarily HR directors, but the people who are basically doing cleanup work in the community. You'd like to get their contact information, and then they're the ones you want to get in touch with as soon as possible.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. We'll write all this up, and actually we've spent our time on this. One of the things is we're going to send some post-session notes out to kind of summarize all these things, and Al, I'll send Tim's respond to your question about brownfields, and if you have any questions, respond back, and we'll pick up on that question. And we're going to meet again in 2 weeks, just for a half hour, 2 to 2:30, October 27th. And we're going to be talking about looking at our participants and talking about some of these jobs that are in our brownfields. And we'll probably touch back on this assessment some more as it relates to the green jobs. So thanks for participating this week, and see you all in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay.
Thank you.